The Bible is crucial for our lives as believers, but some Christians around the world don't have their own copy of God's Word. That's why Crossway is committed to distributing 1 million ESV Bibles to believers in need globally. By God's grace, we've already raised enough to distribute 500,000 copies of the Bible, but we need your help to get more Bibles into the hands of more believers around the world. Between now and Mother's Day, our aim is to raise $200,000, enough to fund the distribution of 50,000 more Bibles, with a special emphasis on reaching women throughout the Global South. Every $4 you give will provide a copy of God's Word to someone who may have never owned their own Bible before. Would you prayerfully consider helping us reach this goal for the good of the global church and the glory of God? To learn more or donate, visit crossway.org/1,000,000Bibles. That's crossway.org/1,000,000Bibles. Thanks. The Puritans often get a bad rap, generally characterized as dour, legalistic, and obsessed with sin and punishment. But despite being so prevalent, such a view isn't actually all that accurate. In short, there's a lot more to the Puritans than you might think. Today I'm talking to Tim Cooper, a church historian who spent his professional life studying one of the most important Puritans of the 17th century, Richard Baxter. We dive into the fascinating history behind Baxter's rise to prominence in his own day, explore his unique approach to pastoral ministry, and discuss what lessons modern Christians, especially church leaders, can learn from his example today. Let's get started. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me today on the Crossway Podcast.
It's a pleasure, Matt. Great to talk to you about Richard Baxter.
So you're a well-known Puritan scholar, someone who spent a lot of time getting to know a group of Christian leaders and thinkers and pastors from history who often, I think I'd have to say, get a bad rap a little bit. They're not necessarily the in the way that they're described, always given a super positive light. So I'm curious if you could explain a little bit how you got into studying the Puritans.
Well, look, Matt, to be honest, it was just providential. Richard Baxter was such a good choice for a PhD topic, but I really can't claim any credit for it. I was here in New Zealand. I just wanted to do a PhD in history. I was interested in the Reformation, and I went to the lecturer who might supervise something on the Reformation, and he had Richard Baxter's unpublished letters and papers on 7 microfilm reels, and he pointed at those and he said, well, what about Richard Baxter? And I did just the slightest bit of reading about Richard Baxter, and I thought, oh well, why not? And I launched in. So you know, it didn't come out of this deep love of the Puritans or even a great awareness of the Puritans. It was the suggestion of my supervisor, but what a great suggestion, because you're right about the Puritans. I mean, who wants to be called a Puritan? So clearly, somehow, it's a bad word. But these are great men and women who have real depth and weight, who take God seriously, who take faith seriously, who take heaven and eternity seriously, take everything seriously. And, you know, in an age of comfort and entertainment and celebrities, I think we can learn something from the Puritans. So, you know, looking back, I had no idea. I you know, I'd love to say this was my choice and it was a great choice. It was a great choice, but it really had little to do with me. It's changed my life, and I'm just grateful to God that that my supervisor had those reels of microfilm. I really am.
Well, so I want to jump into that particular topic right now. Before we keep going, you've said a couple times microfilm, and for the younger listeners right now who are wondering what you're talking about, explain what that was and how you use those.
Oh, I'm showing my age, of course. Yeah, microfilm, this obsolete technology. This is literally a roll of film. Like, imagine a movie reel. But instead of individual frames of moving images, it's individual frames of photographs of original documents. So and hundreds and hundreds and thousands on each reel. I mean, it should have been a clue to me as to how much I was taking on, that there were 7 reels of unpublished material.
So that was just Baxter, seven reels.
Yeah, all Baxter. His letters, he left behind 1,200 letters, either to or from him, but lots of unpublished works that didn't get into print, and copies of some published ones, the original manuscripts. So it's deep archival stuff sitting there on one reel that you put on what was called a microfilm reader, and you go back and forward across the film. But I'm sorry to throw in that reference without realizing. My apologies.
So then you're saying, though, that Baxter was your first encounter with the Puritans as a whole. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
And how is it that your PhD advisor or whoever this person was who kind of got you on to Baxter, what was the history there? How did he or she know about Baxter and the Puritans, and think that would be a good horse of study for you?
Yeah, good question. So Baxter's just an important figure in 17th century English history. Religion is so important to the 17th century, and historians of 17th century England are well used to dealing with religious ideas and religious figures. You have to. You can't disentangle religion from everything else. Baxter wrote a very long autobiography. A lot of his many books were very long, and this was one of them. And that's an important historical document for the 17th century, because he tries to explain how things went wrong for him and his colleagues in the 17th century. So he's an important historical figure for anyone, and that's why my supervisor had those microfilm reels. The strange thing, of course, is that he never used them. He very quickly moved to the UK to take up a role there, and he left me the microfilm reels, which I still have. So he never actually did the work on Baxter that he was planning, but I've done a whole lot.
Yeah, wow. So then maybe give us a little bit of an overview of Baxter's life. You've given us the general time frame. He lived in the 17th century. But help us understand a little bit more about his historical context and the broad contours of his life and ministry.
Good one. So, Matt, this is really interesting. I mean, the 17th century is fascinating, and Baxter lived through it all. So he was born in 1615, and he died in 1691. Throughout the 17th century, there was a huge upheaval. There was King Charles I and Archbishop William Laud, who remodeled the Church of England in a way that looked disturbingly Catholic to a Protestant nation. And the Puritans, of course, were the most Protestant of all. So they created a lot of political instability that gave rise to civil war in the 1640s and war between the three kingdoms of Scotland, England, and Ireland. And out of that, in 1649, the king was executed. And for 11 years, England was a republic. The big name there, of course, is Oliver Cromwell. Then in 1660, everything was reversed. And the monarchy was restored. The bishops of the Church of England were restored. The Puritans, who had been in a position of influence through those years, were ejected from the Church of England, and then ushered in 30 years of persecution, where Puritans, or nonconformists as they were called, were not allowed to teach in schools, were not allowed to minister in churches. And so Baxter lived through all of that, and he also was a key player in some of those events. So when there were negotiations in 1663 to 61, between leading Puritan figures within the Church of England and the bishops who are newly restored, Baxter's one of those key players in there. So he's a very effective minister in his parish of Kidderminster through those years of Republic, through the 1640s and 50s. He's a prolific author. He wrote around 140 books in the course of his life. Some, you're always pleased to discover, are really quite short, but most are very long. So he was just prodigious. He was closely involved, important as a leading figure, and important as a pastor, which of course makes the Reformed Pastor one of his most important books.
So in the era of the Republic, when England did not have a king, could you describe what the Church of England was like? What was the church? How did it function then? You said it was sort of a golden age for the Puritans. Was there a centralized church, or was it sort of diffuse where different congregations could kind of do their own things?
Yeah, good question. So you need to distinguish between the church as it is on the ground and the church as it is in law. The church as it is in law was disestablished. The church as it is on the ground carried on. But without a religious settlement approved by Parliament that would take its place. There were efforts at settlement, but they were ramshackle and incomplete. There was an attempt to bring in Presbyterianism, but that took root only in a few locations, such as London and Lancashire. Otherwise, there was a great deal of freedom to experiment, and Baxter worked this out. So there was no national directive. There was no national settlement to say this is how things are going to be done. So Baxter took his chance in his local parish and with his surrounding ministers to adapt his pastoral ministry to what he felt was the best and most scriptural way of going about it. So there was a lot of freedom, because the bishops, for one thing, had been disestablished. They were in hiding or lying low, and so there was no one really to tell Baxter what to do, so he did his own thing.
Yeah.
With great success.
Well, and so I think you're referring to the, and I'm not even sure I can pronounce this, so you might have to help me with this, the Worcestershire Association. And that was a collection of local ministers who kind of banded together, is that right?
Yeah. So, yes, now that's pretty good approximation. The Worcestershire is how I'd say it, but of course I've got a New Zealand accent, so who can say who's right? The Worcestershire Association. Yeah, so Baxter believed that the pastor in his congregation was the leading figure who had oversight of the souls within that congregation, and not a bishop who existed in a city, you know, tens, hundreds of miles away, with oversight over thousands and thousands of souls. So Baxter thought of himself as the bishop in his congregation. But that didn't mean that he wanted to be isolated and on his own. He wanted to provide a way, a formal way of connecting with his fellow ministers in neighbouring parishes throughout the county of Worcestershire. So he basically invited them to a meeting once a month, and they would all travel to the same place together. They would discuss difficult challenges that they were facing in their ministry, difficult cases of people who might have fallen into sin, and also discuss, you know, big ideas and talk theology. So it's like, I don't know if you have the phrase in the United States, Matt, of a minister's fraternal, but it's a bit like a minister's fraternal. This was Baxter's idea to bring about, and he did it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I think there's similar things in the U.S. and I'm sure abroad, with these kind of loose networks of churches, perhaps, that would kind of approximate what he was going for here. So then speak a little bit to the Reformed Pastor, this really large work that he wrote. You've referenced it a couple times. What was he getting at in this book, and what was he trying to accomplish?
Yeah, good questions. So he wrote the book for one of these meetings. So they plan to gather for a day, and Baxter, it seems, because it's a very long book, was going to speak to them about these aspects of pastoral ministry that they were agreeing to. So as Baxter met with these ministers, it wasn't just month by month and nothing much changed. They also agreed on a common way of working, so that any pastor in that association would go about their ministry in the same way. And one of the important early convictions was that every pastor should know every person individually in his care. And as the years went on through the 1650s, Baxter himself latched onto a method of making that happen. So he devised a process whereby all of the families in his parish who wanted to do this would come to him once a year, and he would examine them on the faith. He would ask them questions. He would see where they were at. He would test their understanding. He would ask how they're going pastorally. He would respond to the issues and concerns that they had. And Baxter found that to be very effective, and wanted to share that with his fellow ministers. So he encouraged them towards the same practice. And this big day, this gathering in December of 1655, was designed to really move them along towards embracing that. As it happens, he was sick on the day, but still he got their agreement. And in 1656, they published their agreement to go about their work in this way. And in the same year, Baxter published The Reformed Pastor, which really lays out his prescription for how pastoral ministry should be done in the context of England in the 1650s.
So was that idea of, personally visiting with congregants on at least an annual basis and kind of having that one-on-one time with them, was that a new or kind of a revolutionary idea for his time? And especially if so, what was behind that conviction that that was a key part of pastoral ministry?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. So it's both new and old. It's old in the sense that Baxter, like all the Puritans, knew his Bible back to front, was very familiar with Acts 20:20, where Paul is talking to the elders at Ephesus, and he reminds them about his ministry among them, and he talks of going house to house. And also he leaves the elders at Ephesus with the command to take care of yourselves and of all the flock. So Baxter was animated by that verse, take care unto yourselves and unto all the flock. And he understood all the flock to mean all the flock, not just some, but all individually, and going house to house. So actually, not just a, like a church meeting on a Sunday, that was great, but not sufficient in itself. He took it from Paul that pastors should also go from house to house, visit individually with families, and have those kind of intimate, personal, deep conversations, and really know their people, know who's in their church. Well, that's certainly revolutionary in mid-17th century England, partly because, as I've mentioned, the existing model had been that you had a bishop of a diocese, and a diocese could have hundreds of thousands of people in it. Well, they did, and I mean, many, it's inconceivable that any bishop in that framework could know individually everyone under their care. So Baxter felt that was hopelessly inadequate, and that pastoral care needed to be done and overseen at the level of the local congregation. So, but boy, meeting individually, that was new. No one did that. That was Baxter's determination, and because it came at a cost. He devoted 2 days a week, he and his assistant, from morning till evening, and families would come hour by hour, and don't think that the 17th century was sort of any less busy than our age. I mean, the Puritans were nothing if not active and busy. But Baxter devoted 2 days out of every week so that he could get through every family in his parish in each year. So yeah, old, drawn from Acts 20. New, no one had applied it like that.
And you said that earlier that families would sort of volunteer, they had to agree to do this, and then they would come to him. And I imagine some people listening right now might think, man, that sounds kind of intense to volunteer to go talk to my pastor and not just maybe share my struggles, but to actually, you seem to suggest there was a level of testing and poking and prodding and kind of ascertaining how they are doing in the faith. What were those meetings like, and what would compel a normal congregant at that time to go do that?
Perhaps I'll start with a general context for you, because you need to imagine an English parish. So an English parish like Kidderminster might have around 2,000 people in it. And it's a mixed bag, right? So everyone who's born in England is baptized and is considered a Christian and a member of the church and therefore a member of the parish. But as you'll appreciate, not everyone lives up to that. So, you know, what do you do with that? And Baxter was so against the separatists who said this is such a mixed bag. It's not pleasing to God. We need to separate and form our own pure congregations. Baxter really, really, really disliked that instinct, but he wanted to reform the parish that he was in, and he did that. So so in a mixed bag parish, where I mean we would have to say certainly not everyone is a Christian, only it was important to Baxter that only those who consented to this were the ones that he worked with, and basically around a third of the parish consented to this. And that was as a result of nearly a decade of his pastoral ministry and his preaching. So he basically turned the town around. This was not promising Puritan territory. Kidderminster was, when he came, utterly uninspiring in terms of any sort of solid Christianity. There might have been one godly family in every street, he says. Before long, people were converting in droves, and you know, he used to keep count, he says, of his early converts, but he lost count. The church filled up; they had to put more seating in it, and so out of that, that whole package, really, I think people were drawn to take part in this. And he, you know, Baxter, I think, must have been a compelling figure for them to do this. But he knew that he had to do it very carefully. So near the end of the book, he gives very clear practical guidance on how you conduct these sessions so as to make sure that people feel comfortable, that you're not out to get them or trip them up or trap them in what they don't know. He's a pastor. I mean, he's an exemplary pastor. He's trying to find a mechanism to be pastoral, and the fact that he pulled it off really is remarkable. I think it's testament to his effectiveness. He must have handled those sessions very well.
Yeah,
he must have been good at these conversations, because if he wasn't, word would get out and no one would come.
Yeah. So our listeners will know that you've recently edited and abridged a version of The Reformed Pastor with Crossway. And at one point early on in the book, you talk about the book's real title. And I found that fascinating and kind of, I didn't know about this beforehand. Can you explain what you mean by that and what the significance of that real title was?
Yeah, sure. So its formal title is Gildas Salvianus. So Gildas Salvianus, : The Reformed Pastor. And you'd think that those two words were a translation of The Reformed Pastor, but they're not. They refer to two famous priests in church history, Gildas and Salvianus, who were known for having spoken hard truths to their fellow priests. They had a reputation for saying what needed to be said to confront their fellow priests, to improve their game. And Baxter put those two names together. It's like he's saying, I am Gildas Salvianus. I'm picking up that tradition. I'm speaking hard truths. Because it is a very challenging book for ministers and pastors and church leaders to read. He lifts the bar. He does not accept indifference. He does not accept poor excuses. He presents a very high vision of what pastors should be doing for the salvation of souls. And he writes with a real urgency because, as I've said earlier, for the Puritans, souls matter. Souls are eternal. Eternity is just seconds away. So he has this enormous urgency and even goes so far as in a long piece of writing that I've condensed, obviously, and put into two chapters. He makes a confession of the sin of England's pastors. He confesses their sin quite a way into the book, having laid out the ideal of what a pastor should be doing. He then confesses that they have not been doing it. And then he goes on to call on their resolve to change their ways. So it's a very confronting book for pastors, and that's why it has the title that it does. He's co-opting that tradition.
Yeah. Well, and given the intense and exhorting nature of the book, at one point you comment that it's almost literally a recipe for burnout. And I guess I wonder, in an age when I think, especially today, many pastors feel a level of burnout. They feel maybe discouraged. They feel like there's a lot of pressures on them and their lives, and yet probably less esteem for pastors than at many times in church history today. Mm-hmm. Why is this message of, you know, a calling to do perhaps more or to work harder or to have higher standards, why is that still relevant? Is that really what pastors need today?
That is a fantastic question. And I mean, I just want to acknowledge what you've just said. Being a church pastor is hard work. I've been a church pastor. I know how hard it is. And, you know, I think no one can really know how hard it is until they've done it. You know, it's hard in unexpected and surprising ways. It's a very, very demanding vocation. And the last thing I would want is to impose Baxter on poor, hardworking pastors who already feel overwhelmed. So I think we have to confront that about the book. It is extremely demanding in its expectations. And at one point, literally, Baxter says, "What is a candle made for but to be burned?" He's calling us to be burned out for God, for ministry, for the care of souls. And we do have to be careful with that. So, you know, I love Baxter, but I can critique him. But what do we do with this? I don't think it's a call to do more. It's a call to revisit how we do what we do. And to ask ourselves whether we are providing the individual soul care that our people need. Now, it's challenging, but I think it's a challenge we need to hear. It's not a challenge that we need to hear and beat ourselves up about. That's not helpful. We live in a different age. Quite a different age. People are much, much more mobile. There is any number of churches that people can go to. So it's not like we can just pick up what Baxter did and do it for ourselves. But what you get running through the book more than his methodology is his heart. And I think that's inspiring, because then you can read Baxter and you can find an ally. You can find someone who says, what you're doing is hard and demanding, and I'm expecting a lot, but it's important. It matters. Here's why it matters. Here's why it has this value. I think the Puritans in general are helpful in that way, in that they speak with a different voice. So Baxter's voice is different. I've modernized his English. We'll understand it much more easily. But he's still got a different voice, and that's helpful. I think that voice is one that we need to hear to reinforce and help us to galvanize our courage and strength and resilience to carry on. But no one should feel, overwhelmed by this book or overwhelmed by Baxter or feeling a failure to measure up. But that is a real challenge of the book. It hasn't stopped me from putting it out there. I think we need to read this book again. I think a new generation of pastors needs to have a way of reading this classic text on what it is to be a pastor, but with some care.
Yeah, right. I wonder if you could speak a little bit. You've kind of alluded to this already, that soon after this short-lived era of the Republic, the monarchy was reestablished, and the Church of England as a national entity was reformulated, and things changed very quickly for the Puritans and for Baxter in particular. What impact did that ultimately have on his life and ministry?
Huge. See, the 1650s were so encouraging for Baxter. He saw his parish transformed. He saw other parishes transformed. He worked with his fellow ministers. In other counties, other associations sprang up, like his one. He'd published his book. He'd published lots of books. He was a best-selling author. A remarkably successful author. And by the end of the 1650s, he has visions of a reformed nation. He thinks the Reformation can be completed if it can only carry on. But it all comes undone. And it comes undone in large part because of disunity among the Puritans themselves. And that's something he'd been trying to mend throughout the 1650s. Part of the Worcestershire Association is about unity and working together, despite any differences in theology. So when it all comes apart, and it comes apart politically as much as anything, England just falls into chaos, and people want stability, and the king is brought back. And the Puritans were important in bringing the king back, let's understand that. But they brought the king back without placing any constraints on his power. And the bishops were restored, and they wanted things the way that they had been, and they had no great interest in the Puritan vision of the Church of England. So the terms were very, very harsh. You had to agree to everything that the church did, basically, and say, yes, I agree with this. And Puritans couldn't do that. And because they couldn't do that, they couldn't be ministers in the Church of England. So Baxter left Kidderminster for London to be involved in this negotiations. He never went back. He was not allowed to preach again in that church. He was not allowed to go back and say goodbye. In fact, a law came in the mid-1660s that prevented nonconformist ministers from going within 5 miles of they had ministered in the past. And people were fined, people were imprisoned. Baxter was imprisoned during this next period. There were very limited opportunities to preach. So it changes Baxter's life, but he carries on. And he carries on his ministry largely by writing books. Now, it's difficult to get a book licensed to be published in this period, but he manages it. And he continues to publish a lot of books. But boy, it is a hard life, Matt. It is a hard life and a bitter, bitter disappointment. That reversal in 1660, Baxter never quite recovered.
Well, maybe as a last question, I wonder if you could speak to the person listening right now. Maybe it's a pastor. Maybe it's just a layperson who appreciates history and theology and who is interested in Baxter. Now that they've heard you share a little bit about him, but still would have to say they feel a little bit intimidated perhaps by the thought of digging into a Puritan. They've heard the scary stories about Puritan writings and just wonder, could I get through that? Why would you say it's worth persevering and taking a stab at reading The Reformed Pastor?
If there is one book in English that every pastor should read, it's The Reformed Pastor. The trouble is, the original is basically unreadable. this edition, it'll never get any easier than this, Matt. It's in modern English. It all flows. It's very, very tidy and understandable. And for Baxter, short. 30,000 words.
The original was how long?
Yeah, 160,000 words.
Oh, wow.
So I have removed most of it. But what I've left behind, and I hope readers will agree with me on this, is the genius of the book at the core. I've taken out the repetition. I've taken out the stuff that doesn't matter. I've taken out the tangents. I've taken out long Latin quotes. And what's left is what I think Baxter wanted to say. So Baxter, as you can tell from the microfilm reels, from the 140 books, he never shut up. Well, I've kind of set him down and told him to shut up. And just tell us, Richard, what's the essence of what you want to say to us?
Yeah.
If I were to get him back today and say, what's your message for us that you were trying to get across in the Reform Pastor? Please, Richard, say it in far fewer words. This is what I think it is. So here's your chance to read the Reform Pastor, and you will get the book. You will get what Baxter had in that whole large book, but you won't have to work nearly so hard for it. I was presenting on Baxter at a pastor's conference a couple of years ago, and one of the pastors, he told me, you know, I've loved to read the Reform Pastor. I've tried three times, and each time I've not made it. Well, anyone can make it through this book. And you will get the message that Baxter was trying to get across. Of course, then you've got to sort of live with that message and make it your own, and that's challenging. But at least you know what it is. And it's a message still worth hearing, in part because, you know, it comes out of Acts 20. Acts 20 is still in our Bibles. What are we going to do with it? How are we going to take that call to ministry seriously? So I hope pastors who read this book will be challenged, yes, but fortified and encouraged about the value of what they do. And I hope anyone reading this book who's not a pastor will also get an insight into what it is to be a pastor and how to live under and encourage your pastor.
Well, thank you so much, Tim, for giving us a little insight into Richard Baxter's life and ministry and this important book that he wrote. We really appreciate you taking the time today.
Good one. Thank you, Matt. I've loved the chat. So thanks for talking about Richard Baxter.
That was Tim Cooper on Richard Baxter. For more, be sure to check out his freshly edited and condensed edition of Baxter's classic work, The Reformed Pastor, available online or at your local Christian bookstore. For more interviews like this, subscribe to the Crossway Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review, which helps us spread the word about the show. Crossway is a not-for-profit Christian ministry that exists solely for the purpose of proclaiming the truth of God's Word through publishing gospel-centered content. Visit us today at crossway.org.